them up here.
I'm going fish, 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 fishing. I'm going fishing. Hook, sinker, and line.
Ah, with the coughing and the hacking, and you can tell I have a great, healthy lifestyle. Yes, that's me. There, in the cough seat. There's a
pillar of health.
The pillar of health.
The pillar of health. I love it.
Fish and Frank here. The debates rage on. The questions are unending. Email me, frank@fishandfranks.com. If you can remember what those things were called. We're doing a mural on the back wall of the store. And it's got grouper and sailfish and snappers and amberjack and all these other things on there. And we're putting company logos into the picture, but you got to actually look for them. It's not like they're sitting there. Okay, there's Penn or there's AFW
boring,
or whatever.
Yeah.
So you got to actually look to see the logos in there. And there used to be a thing came out in the newspaper, and I know it was in some of the magazines, where you looked at a picture, and inside of that picture, you had to find like a guitar, a bicycle, a monkey head, you know, whatever it would be in that picture. And I can't remember. It's not a jumble. It's not a... I don't remember what they called that when you did that, where you're looking at a picture, but hidden inside of the picture was, you know, different objects. And that's what I was thinking about with the mural. And we got Tim painting, and it's coming out really cool. You know, it's just a weird, ugly wall at the store. And I thought, well, this would be really cool if we could put all kinds of fish on there. Not thinking, it's corrugated. It goes in ripples up and down. If it was a flat wall, he would have been done a week ago. But this poor guy's got to paint these fish, airbrush, freehand fish on there, that... where the metal has ridges coming in and out of it. Oh my God, it's taking forever.
Robert, he said old and weird. Do you think we can get Tim to paint Frank?
Yeah, they're going to put a picture of me on there that kind of sums up old and weird in one. Look it up in the dictionary. Webster's best. All right. Oh yeah, old and weird. There's a picture of me. Got it. we know that's going on. We started doing seminars at the store, and we're on our fifth one. I think it was fourth or fifth yesterday. Wednesday has become seminar day. We built a brand new seminar area, and it was working pretty good. The first one, we didn't know how to block the wind when the wind blew out of the north, so we froze. And I figured out how to block the wind, a couple pieces of foam board that we can take up and down, blocks the wind, and it's very comfortable back there. Last night, it was very nice. You step out in front of the store, freeze your butt off, go in the seminar area. It was 10, 15 degrees nicer. It was actually very comfortable back there. I figured out the wind and cold thing. Then yesterday morning, it's raining during the seminar. And I thought, no problem. The roof sticks out like 8, 10 inches past that last row over there. Mm-hmm. And I forgot water has a tendency to roll off of a lip, roll back up it, and then drip down again. It doesn't, like, roll off the edge. That little bit, kind of, that drip always runs back along it. So everybody on the outside was getting wet. So we got through the first seminar, so I ran over my scrap pile, digging around, and I grabbed these, like, they're 13, 14-inch wide aluminum panels and put those up for gutters. So started 11, by 2 o'clock I was caulking them, and we were able to get the seats dry, and for the 2 o'clock and the 6 o'clock seminars, it actually worked out really nice.
Worked out very well.
But I'm up there in a ladder, they're talking about redfish and snook and how to do this, and I'm shooting screws and caulking, and, you know, and everybody just looks at me, it's like, well, this is normal, Frank's, you know, tearing something up or doing something, you know, while we're listening to a fishing seminar. They go, work in progress, huh, Frank? They're so cool.
Yeah, they are. They're kind of used to it.
Yeah, we're always tearing something up or doing something or moving something. come in, there's boxes piled up everywhere, and they just kind of move the box around. Okay, that's what I'm looking for. But trying to figure out whether or not to do these seminars and when to do them and all that, and we decided on Wednesday because of the parking.
Right.
There's, you know, when you've got 40 cars showing up all at one time, you get a lot of parking for that.
Yes, you do.
So the parking's worked out good. Park in front of the store, out back behind, or even across the street. There's a big parking lot in Edgewater. But trying to, whenever you're trying to do something different that nobody has really pulled off before, there's always benefit detriments. And Robert brought up a good point in the truck coming up here.
With the detriments?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of our specialties is helping customers, and we enjoy that part of it because I don't like to sort shrimp or dust.
You don't want to be dusting the packages or, you know, taking the whisk room to the hats. And,
right.
I know you're a big fan of cleaning the bait room floor.
Right. So, you know, it's really nice to be able to spend the time with the customers, especially a lot of your new anglers, to teach them the knots or spend time with them showing them some different lures. And during these seminars, sometimes it gets a little too hectic to, A, pay attention to who's there for the seminar and who's just a daily customer coming in for the first time, and B, being able to actually spend that time with them that you want to devote to them.
Because it's about a half an hour before the seminar and a half hour after, it gets pretty chaotic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're going to miss people.
Yeah, and it's...
and you do that on the... Sometimes you miss people on a daily thing just because the hardest thing for us to know when someone walks in the door, we don't know who they are, they were coming in for the first time, and how do you know if they just won the Louisiana Redfish Cup or are a tournament angler or have never seen saltwater before?
Right. There's just no way to tell. So you end up spending a few minutes talking to them and discussing different things, and then you kind of get a better idea. But sometimes when you're rushing, you forget a couple of the little key questions that you should ask or need to ask, and it makes me personally feel bad. I don't like overlooking
that stuff.
That's
why Robert's there, because if he's not trying to do, you know, all these little things, he gets feeling bad about it. The one thing about all this is trying to figure out stuff. Now, Jerry, you haven't been down to do the seminars. And for the local audience, have you ever been here on Wednesday night at WKDW? If you haven't, you should show up. It's pretty awesome. You do what, Wednesday night?
Wednesday night's open mic night. And last night we actually had to turn a couple of musicians away because we only have 15 slots to play, 15, 11-minute slots. We had about 60 people in the hall.
Yeah, because if you haven't been here, this is awesome. They've got all different kinds of people with guitars, and I came in. There's a guy using drumsticks on a cardboard box with, I think, a cymbal. It might have been something else, but he was drumming for the guy with the guitar, and it was actually really cool. It was kind of like, if you're around my age, maybe a little younger than me, but
hopefully
that beatnik thing in the 60s, you know, if you remember that, there's a little bit of that coffee house flair to it, that old beatnik thing. So that's right here on Wednesday nights. We do seminars at the bait shop on Wednesdays, 9:30 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, and 6 o'clock at night. Same seminar all day, just so we can get all the people through there, because we've got a couple hundred people on Wednesday. We usually get about 200 people going through the store all day with the seminars and the customers and stuff. So it gets a little chaotic. We get a lot of people working. But and the hardest thing about these seminars, and this was the trickiest part, is getting the manufacturers not to do an hour advertisement for their products.
Right. Because they're like our special guest kind of sponsors of the talks.
Right, they just come, they're going to give deals on their products and tell people how to catch fish, but not sit there and do an hour ad for their products. That we have one guy who started on that, and I was able to go up there, get on the mic, and just kind of redirect everything. But it was, good God, I don't care about your product that much. I don't have one product in the store that I'm going to listen to for an hour.
No.
You know, forget that. So But it's been fun. A lot of fishing information, a lot of couples.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of husbands and wives and girlfriend, boyfriend stuff that just show up to fish.
Well, anyway, that was too much time for that. But anyway, so the seminars are kind of fun. A little bit good, a little bit bad. But it's been a lot of fun, and we're going to keep doing them for a while. Just got off the phone with Mark Nichols, the owner of DOA. He's coming to do seminars. If you have not met Mark Nichols, you need to shake the hand of a legend.
Oh,
he's one of my favorite people. He is amazing. One of the best fishermen to ever live. And he's going to be at the store doing that. We got Yo Zuri. We got all kinds of other people. But Mark Nichols is coming, man.
Well, they should be able to go to the website and look at the seminars.
Yeah, fishingfranks.com. But what's the trout fishing doing, Robert?
It's picking up a little bit this past week. Still, the ICW is where all of your bigger, more consistent fish are at. But numbers have been starting to pick up a little bit over on the east wall, mostly on the outside edge of the bar, but they have been getting a few on the inside of the bar on that little trough there. It's still wishy-washy, so you got to cover ground. That's the most important part. These fish aren't in their normal spots. They're not inside Pirate Harbor. They're not at the mouth of Alligator Creek. You know, they're not in the Burnt Store Channel.
I'd say 3 more degrees and things are going to go to where they normally go.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm skeptical of all that this year with the trout. They're weird.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, with just fish in general, the snook, the redfish, the trout, the sheephead, everything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think in
general. 3 more degrees, if the water comes up 3 more degrees, it's just going to just shock into existence.
Yeah, definitely. You know, so just get out there and drift around or trolling motor around and cover some ground. That's the most ideal way. And live shrimp has been working the best on the trout, but they've also been getting a lot of them on a lot of soft plastics, lightly bouncing them along the bottom, not working them so much under the bobbers or the floats underneath, you know, a couple feet. They're actually getting more fish by slowly hopping them off the bottom 6 inches to a foot.
And this is definitely not normal trout fishing activity. Usually trout fishing, you're up on a popping cork, you're making some surface noise. And the cool thing about a popping cork is when you go to pop it, that's simulating the sound of a fish hitting a bait, like a bass hitting the surface, a trout smacking the surface. It works in freshwater, saltwater. Freshwater guys don't do it. I don't know why. But you get that sound of a fish hitting a bait. What people really don't realize as much is in order to pop the bobber or the cork, you at the same time it jumps the bait. So you get the sound of a fish eating, plus the appearance of your lure and or bait escaping a predator.
Right, absolutely. So you've got the visual and the vibration, so you're covering multiple scenarios to draw in those fish. But for some reason this year, they're just not seeming to be as aggressive. Because usually that's, like you said, the popping cork is working good. A couple of guys have been picking up a couple on topwater lures early in the morning, throwing the small, like, Spook Juniors and the Rapala Skittervy. Is that the other top
one?
Yeah,
the Skittervy is awesome.
The Skittervy has been a really popular one here the last probably 2 to 4 weeks, has really gained some momentum.
I'm going to try that Berkeley thing with the... It's kind of like a longer version of a Whopper Plopper, which is kind of a lure buzzbait.
Right.
And on the back of it, there's this little plastic lip that rotates like a blade, and it sits right at the surface. And if you were going to try and troll a topwater, that would be an awesome trolling one for a topwater.
Yeah, that
might
be pretty
interesting. It's going to go slop, 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 really give a lot of surface noise to it. But if I was going to take it out for snook, it's easier than a Zara Spook, a Top Pup, a Skitter Walk, a Skitter V, because you got to walk the dogs with those. Very specific.
Right.
With that, you just give it a rip. Just get your rod tip low to the water, tighten your line up, and then pull back 2 or 3 feet. Stop, reel it up, tighten it up again, pull it 2 or 3 feet.
Yeah.
And just keep doing that. And those fish are going to come to it. All you want that prop to do is go around and slash the surface.
Yeah, it just creates a whole lot of activity on the surface, like it's a fleeing bait fish, or in some instances, you know, a frog swimming across the surface.
All right.
So it's working out pretty well.
Do you realize 14,000 people listen to us?
No.
On the internet while we're doing this.
That's pretty crazy.
There's 14,000 people. I was just reading it here. There's 14.25 thousand people listening to us. Hello, Sam, Harry, Ralph, Steve, the other Frank out there, the other Robert. There's a whole bunch of Randy. Hey, guys. Trying to list everybody. Want to say thank you.
What about Susie or Ethel?
Well, Ethel, her and I aren't getting along that well, but Susie's awfully nice.
Okay.
Okay.
Just covering her bases.
I just didn't want to bring it up with Ethel. It's a personal thing. You know. Issues. Let's see.
Go back to that weird thing, right?
Yeah. I was getting the paint can out from under the counter here.
Out in the Gulf, snappers, grunts, porgies, sheephead. Guy going out, he says the fish aren't biting. I said, using squid, right? Yeah. I said, yeah, there's your problem.
Yeah, yeah, the guys are...
Squid is not getting it right now.
Not very well. I mean, it's some guys is doing okay, but shrimp is dominating it. Sardines are working absolutely incredible, cut into pieces. A couple guys have been doing well on the mullet, cut up in little pieces.
That kind of surprises me. I don't know why the squid all of a sudden took a low ebb. One of my general rules of thumb, if I'm going out in the Gulf of Mexico, I carry squid and Spanish sardines.
Always.
Those, I just want to have them, got to have them. But right now, you need a pail of shrimp, preferably live shrimp, 2-aught hook, 1-aught, 2-aught hook, some 30-pound test leader, and a couple ounce, 2 ounces of lead.
Yeah.
Get it down to the bottom. Yellowtail snappers. I mean, people drive all the way to the Keys to do yellowtail snapper fishing. Save yourself the trip. They're here now in huge numbers. How deep you got to go for them, Robert?
They're catching them in as close as 50 feet of water, but most of the guys are doing best with those true flag yellowtail, like 3 to 4 pound fish in about 65 to 70 feet of water.
So you get out 60, 65 feet of water, get on a decent reef structure, and drop a live shrimp down there. Bang, yellowtail, bang, yellowtail, bang, yellowtail.
And the thing with those is hang your chum bag over the side, fish your bottom rigs the way you normally would, but for the yellowtail with consistency, use one of those circle hook jig heads, the 3/8 ounce or the 1/2 ounce, and put the shrimp on it and just open the bail and let it slowly tumble out with the current and the tide as it's slowly sinking down. Similar technique as what you do in the Keys, but these fish are much larger. You know, the average yellowtail in the Keys in the last several years has been a pound, pound and a half, with the exception of the real good fishermen down there. But you're still struggling. But these fish here are 2, 3, 3.5, 4 pounds. Really nice, nice yellowtail.
Yeah, we're not talking trophy fish here. We're talking dinner fish.
Right.
We're talking lunch, supper. This is grocery fishing.
Absolutely.
You know, this isn't, okay, I caught the most exciting fish of my life. This is like, oh, my God, does my belly feel good.
Yeah.
That was a taste treat.
Absolutely. And all the other bottom fish that you're catching, too, the squirrel fish, the grunts, the sheep's head have been doing really well out there in all those near shore
reefs. So
what's
up with the sheep head out there? Isn't that like a pier fish?
Normally, yes. Normally, they're associated with pilings and all sorts of structure, but reefs are structures, and there's a lot of times those fish move out on the reefs, and so far, the ones that are out there on the reefs are doing really exceptionally well. The ones that are along the...
What are they hitting?
Shrimp.
Really?
Guys are catching them on shrimp, and a few guys are doing fish bites.
Steve went out with fish bites the other day. He loaded the frickin' boat on him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any shrimp or anything with him. He took the shrimp fish bites and just the pink ones. He was cut an inch and a quarter long strip, sticking on the hook, and just waylaid it.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised. And I believe in fish bites, but I didn't think it would work that good. I really honestly didn't. To me, it's always been a backup, never kind of a primary. And Steve used it as a primary and loaded the boat.
Yeah. No, and I've done that with your father, so it doesn't surprise me.
Okay.
You know, that several years ago when they forgot it on that overnight trip, your father and I sat there with the fish bites and caught trigger fish, red porgies, knobhead porgies, and gag grouper and red grouper all on those fish bites because they had forgotten the squid and something else on that trip.
Yeah.
So we had a blast. So it's amazing how well it works.
And what's nice is Fish Bites is made in St. Augustine, Florida. So not only is it a USA company, it's a Florida company. So
right,
double cool. If you were going to go out to the reefs, fiddler crabs, yes, no, or indifferent?
Honestly, I'm going to be indifferent with it just because I know they're going to work on the sheep's head and I know they'll work on the other species, but I like the shrimp because I know I'm going to catch all sorts of stuff on the shrimp.
All right, RJ, fiddler crabs, indifferent?
I would not even have thought to bring a fiddler crab out to deep water. I mean, do you ever find them out there? I mean, I may be completely wrong about this, but they're an estuary, shallow water type of critter.
And yeah.
And so, you know, snook, redfish, anything that's in relatively shallow water. But I think when you get out into deep water, I mean, yeah, it's a crab. I mean,
that,
everybody eats crabs.
That's the key point right there is that they don't really necessarily recognize it as a fiddler crab. They just recognize it as a crab.
Mm.
You know, whether the enzymes and scent that it might put off might be slightly different than, say, another type of crab, but they're looking at it physically as just, hey, this is lunch no matter what.
Well, and that discussion we just had is a good example of the difference between how a fish thinks and how a fisherman thinks. Right? Because I'm sitting here thinking about it, and then Robert says, well, you know, it's a crab. So
yeah,
he's right, you're right. The fish is going to say, hey, it's a crab. Let's eat it.
Well, and even that being said, fiddler crabs are not really totally a normal diet of any fish.
They live on land.
They live on land. Yeah, so they're more of a diet for a heron. If you want to go out and catch a heron or an egret, fiddler crabs are perfect bait.
I've seen otters eat them.
You know, so it's just more about that it's a easily accessible type of bait that is now commercially farm-raised.
Right. We're actually buying farm-raised fiddler crabs, and we look long and hard. I don't like the fact that I won't sell wild shiners for bass. I refuse to do it. I'll go out of business before I sell them. I don't like the fact that they go around to Charlotte County, Sarasota County, wipe us out of freshwater shiners to haul them and sell them to guys fishing Okeechobee. And they go to every county. These guys are on the move all the time, throwing cast nets everywhere because they're wild shiners.
Yeah.
And the only way to catch them is in the wild. So they got to go around and rape and pillage the whole damn state to keep some of these big lakes in very expensive shiners. I sell farm-raised shiners. I don't want to be destroying our environment because I'm selling bait.
Right.
And so I was super stoked to get farm-raised fiddler crabs.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Because there, I can name you probably 8-10 spots that had fiddler crabs here in Charlotte County 10-15 years ago that there are none now. And one of these days I'm going to buy an extra 1,000 fiddlers, and I would never take them, release them into the wild on beaches where there used to be fiddler crabs, because that would be illegal. But I would think about it.
Absolutely.
I would think about it. Just see if they take.
Oops, right. I dropped the bucket.
Oops. I was fishing. I just got frustrated. That bucket fell over. It didn't. There was only 500 baits in there. I just couldn't catch them all. You know, so. I'm just not sure going out, how long is this shrimp thing going to last on these offshore reefs? The shrimp migration usually ends, what, March, April?
Yeah. Usually towards the end of April, because usually our best shrimping is normally March and April out there along the intercoastal. So I would say more towards the end of April it should fizzle out, but because it started early this year and has been so incredible, I don't know where to go with it. I'm not really sure.
I wouldn't fall in love with shrimp out there. I would keep taking a little bit of squid with you, because I'm going to say fairly soon this shrimp phenomenon bite in the Gulf of Mexico is going to be over, because the migration's going to slow down. Right now, pretty much every night, there's probably 500 to 1,000 shrimp swimming by every reef out there.
Oh, at least.
And thousands of shrimp going out there. So once that's over, they're going to go back to the squid. Because this is the first time when it's been this dramatic a difference. Usually, squid, sardines, got to have them. Right now, you've got to bring the shrimp with you, but I don't think this is going to last.
No, I don't think it will either. And the other thing that will give you a better idea on how many shrimp are out there right now, there's at least a half a dozen shrimp boats that have been out there the last 2 weeks from Inglewood Beach down to Sanibel, about 6 to 12 miles out, that have been anchored up.
You know, if these eco-idiot captains and that ridiculous CCA, the Crummy Criminals Association, I hate the CCA. They've made me mad for the last time. I'm just saying I don't like them, I'm done with it. If they want to do something good, why don't they actually get the shrimping closed for commercial shrimping to mirror the Texas and the Louisiana and Alabama closures and make the whole dang Gulf closed for those times so that all the boats from every other state don't come here to take what should be food for our fish. There's almost no Florida boat shrimping them. They're all from out of state.
Oh, yeah, you go out there and look at any of them. Most of them are Texas and Louisiana because they are shut down this time of year.
Why doesn't Florida shut it down and eliminate? These guys drive all the way over from Texas, Louisiana, to shrimp Florida's coast. Why aren't we shut down when they're shut down? It just makes sense.
Absolutely.
I mean,
there should be closed seasons on a lot of different fish, for that matter.
I mean, it's just, to me, if you're going to do something beneficial, let's get more food for the fish, which means less shrimpers out there in the Gulf doing it. And they go in the harbor, they shrimp the whole harbor. As soon as it gets rough in the Gulf at all, they just pull up and down the harbor. I went out there, coming back one night during shrimping season, I literally could not figure out where I was. There was so many boats out there, it was lit up like a small city. And everybody goes, well, there's nobody shrimping in the harbor. I go out all the time, I don't see them. Are you out at 1 o'clock in the morning? Give me a break, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't see it on TV, it didn't happen. let's see. Where are we here?
Let's talk about the juvenile tarpon a little bit, because that's been unusual.
Are we actually going to be able to do a tarpon report this week?
I think we're going to be able to do a little one this week, you know, because I've had several different reports from guys. I don't know if it was because the water temperature warmed up perfect for them or what, but right here in the Myakka, in the upper Myakka from, say, Eljo Bean up to the 41 Bridge, and even a few spots up above the 41
Bridge. The 41 Bridge in Northport.
Northport, Myakka River.
Yeah, Myakka River.
You know, especially right over here from the 41 Bridge down to, there's a couple trailer parks that are right there on the water. That little stretch there has been holding some juvenile tarpon that have been actually chewing from 10 pounds to 40 pounds. And guys, there was one guy that did it 2 days in a row, mostly using shrimp. But a couple other guys have said they've hooked up using some artificials while looking for snook up there. And then on the Peace River, kind of the same scenario. Guys are catching them up there by Shell Creek a little bit, and then up around the Navigator and just above the Navigator on Baitbusters, Terror Eyes, and Shrimp. And they're actually kind of targeting those fish.
So Terror Eyes, Baitbusters, up on the Peace River, but more of a shrimp bite on the Myakka River.
Right.
So now, float, no float on the Myakka River. Bobber, no bobber.
I'm going to do both.
I mean, see which way it works.
Yeah, I'm going to put one under a bobber and set it in the rod hole, and the other one I'm going to be casting and seeing where they're at and cooperating. You know, but it's been enough different people that have been catching them accidentally and then trying to target them and still catching them, so it's definitely worth a good honorable mention, without a doubt.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just looking down, and I've still got this 14,000 people listening to the show. After the first 10 minutes of the show, 13,000 of them clicked off. But getting on the inside, we're getting Jack's big cobia in the harbor.
Yeah.
Any in the intercoastal, like Lemon Bay anywhere, anything like that?
The jacks have been there sporadically, but no, the majority of what I've been hearing about has been inside the harbor.
All right.
And it's a lot more jacks with a handful of cobia. On the east side and the west side, just on the outside of the bar, guys are actually looking for them because that water temperature is getting perfect. I still don't think that there's going to be good or great, I should say great fishable numbers of cobia for at least another couple weeks, but because usually March, mid-March, all the way through middle of April is usually our best times. But with as warm as the water is, as much little fry has been in the harbor, And as clear as that water is and as calm as it's been, I think guys are going to be out there looking for them and sight fishing them a little bit more often.
Well, you know? Cobia and jacks fall underneath the same ridiculous envelope.
Yeah, they do.
You can throw anything out there and they will eat it, or forget it, they're not going to eat a darn thing. I hate it. I get on a, you know, I'll see a school of jacks, boom, 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 blow it up, blow it up, blow it up, and then I run the boat around, drop it, get real quiet in the water, put some baits out, and watch them come up, just go boom, right around the boat and not feed, and not see them again feed, you know, for 100 yards before the boat and 100 yards after the boat. And then I pack up, go, okay, the heck with it, and I'll start running around. And the motor's running, and I'm actually going out. And all of a sudden, they start blowing up and feeding again. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about sheer frustration on the fin. I mean, I've had cobia sitting 3 feet off the back of the boat. Won't hit a darn thing. You're putting lures in front of them, baiting in front of them.
The most frustrating fish to catch is a cobia. Drive you crazy. You find one out by one of the buoys, and you know, it's a big fish, and you actually may see him hit something. And you throw everything in the tackle box at him, everything in the bait well at him, and he'll swim over and look at it, and then swim back to the buoy, and you'll end up leaving totally frustrated. You know, you almost wish you had brought a bow and arrow to fish with.
I'm thinking more 12-gauge. I'm no good with
the 12-gauge. That's right. 12-gauge would probably do it, yeah.
They are definitely frustrating because it's like when they're on, they are easy, dumb,
I mean, you can literally
fish.
Sometimes walk up standing within 3 feet of a cobia and drop a lure there, a spoon right from it, boom, sucks it right up, bait on a hook, whatever, they'll just suck it right up, boom, big fish on, and then the next time, forget it. And jacks are the same way.
Yeah.
I always thought of jacks as you throw a spoon into that school, you're going to hook a fish.
Yeah, you know? Not anymore for me.
And I don't know what it is lately, if they're getting a little smarter. Now, if a Jack Crevel would learn to jump, it'd be the number one game fish in the world overnight. All he has to do is tail walk a little bit, and no one would ever be allowed to keep one again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because it would be the ultimate game fish.
Yeah.
A 30-pound Jack Crevel outpull 100 pounds of any other fish.
Yeah, they're pretty impressive.
Really impressive.
I mean, I would like to catch a 30-pounder just to see what that feels like. I've not done that before.
I got it's around 40 pounds, different type of jack, same basic fish in the Pacific.
Right.
And I've caught some big jacks probably in the 20-pound range, but I don't think I've ever got into the 30s.
Yeah.
On regular Jack Crevel.
I think my biggest one personal is like 18 pounds, if I remember
right.
Right,
far apart.
You know, it's amazing, though. I mean, the fighting of them is so utterly impressive. You know, I want to catch a GT. That's high on my list. But they catch the... A GT, a giant trevally.
Oh, a giant...
That's like its cousin.
He's talking in code. We're on radio. Yeah. It's like when the guys come on the show and they're gesturing. And if you do this, you'll catch a lot of fish like that. And they always have a face for radio. Okay, right. But anyway.
Well, to go back to cobia.
It's a 100-pound jack.
Yeah, go back to cobia.
Go back to cobia for a minute. There's one thing that all cobia fishermen do after attempting to fish for cobia.
What's that?
Yeah.
Have a drink.
I just poured myself a Jameson's.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm looking over there. Robert can't see that far, but...
Nope.
I'm looking over, RJ's got a bottle there into the coffee it goes. He did not put any in my Diet Coke, but I do have to drive back, so probably a good thing.
Cobia definitely are frustrating. But,
now,
but they
small
are catching
lures them. Close to the surface. If you see a school of Jack Crevel busting, I can't tell you how many guys say, man, I saw this big school of fish busting out there, and I threw my bait right into him, and never got a hit. I said, well, how are you rigged up? Well, I had my hook about 24 inches a leader. It's good. Had a half-ounce sinker on. What? Now, wait a minute. You could see the fish, right? And how deep was the water in? 8 feet. So you wanted your bait 8 feet below the fish?
Yeah.
Because I don't know how quick, yeah. But if you see a school of fish out there, one of the reasons people catch them so much on spoons is you get really excited when you see the jacks. So you're reeling in a little faster. That keeps the spoon right up by the surface. And that's what really the jacks are looking for. They're coming up from below to push these fish up towards the surface because they can't go any higher than the surface of the water. Right. They can jump out a little bit, but they're going to fall back into the water. No gravity thing there. So they come up and corral these bait fish and push from the bottom trying to get the fish to come to the surface where they can be captured. If you don't have a dead end of a canal or a basin, like a marina basin, these fish try to corral these fish and push them to the surface because they can go no higher than the top of the water. It's a wall to push them against. So they're pushing them up, and then you throw something and it goes way down, you're defeating the purpose.
Absolutely. You know, and where was I going with that? This time of year, all times of year, you should always have your rod rigged up with just a spoon. There should always be a spare rod.
Even a bucktail jig would work because and a spoon, you can fish down deep, you can fish up top.
Yeah.
A bucktail and a spoon kind of like the same thing, isn't it, RJ?
Pretty close.
I mean, you can reel it quickly with your rod tip raised way up in the air and get it up high in the water, or you can let it sink down to the bottom.
Yeah, I go with Robert on the spoon. You should always have a rig with a spoon on it.
Yeah, the versatility of both is absolutely amazing, but I'm just a little bit more preferable to a spoon because, like you said, you tend to get excited and reel a little too fast, and at least you're getting a lot of good reflection out of it because it's not going to change the shape of it as you're retrieving it versus a bucktail kind of can shrink it down to get it almost too streamlined where I don't know if they'd miss it or not versus when you're jigging and it puffs up, doing what a bucktail is supposed to. That would be my only thought process on it. But at the same time, they do eat a lot of those little tiny skinny minnows that are up on the surface where that skinny profile, that bucktail, might work.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a couple of discussions about if you only had one lure to take with you to go for this particular fish or this kind of water, I would always go with a spoon. And you get a silver spoon and you get a gold spoon. And you could probably go anywhere on the planet and catch just about anything.
Freshwater, saltwater, stuffy spoons. I mean, you still have to wonder about the mindset of the first guy to drill a hole at both ends of a tablespoon.
Yeah.
And tie it on his fishing line. All right.
And you know, we did that as kids. I mean, we'd drive grandma nuts because she'd be missing silverware, but... And, you know, you pound it a little bit to get the shape you want, drill a hole on each end, and then go out fish. And up north, the bluefish was the big one for spoons.
Right.
And you know, teaspoons versus a tablespoon was depending on which size fish was in the harbor at that particular time.
You know, I'm sitting here looking at this bottle of Jameson on your desk thinking, no wonder we're such good friends. I have a thing of moonshine sitting on my desk, and then I have a bottle of booze from China, my buddy brought back when he came back from China. Patrick Sabeel brought it for me. So I have this, it's not sake, but it's some kind of, you know, they call it wine, but I mean, it's like high-end booze. And I'm sitting there looking, going, no wonder we get along so well.
Just sometimes a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
Yeah, well, you know, we're not like daffodil ones. So anyway, getting back into this, right now, Robert, do you think it was a red tide that cleared the water up so much?
I think that definitely helped. I mean, this time of year, the water gets clear naturally anyway, but for the last several weeks, the water has been exceptionally clear. And because red tide, when it blooms at an alarming rate at times, it competes against all the other algaes and microalgaes, macroalgaes, both. It sucks up all the nutrients away, so it basically essentially starves out all the other algaes in the area, which creates a massive amount of clean water.
So
once it floats away and dies or shrinks up, you know, it's amazing the long-term effects afterwards of red tide with the clarity of the water.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the things. Red tide is in no way good, but you do have to look all points of everything.
Well, look at it as a forest fire. I mean,
only if you live in a city in California do you see things one way and no other way.
Right. You know, forest fires are absolutely sad and destroy so many things, but look at the amount of life that forms after a fire.
And look at the grasses, the beetles. They got beetles destroying forest all over the place, and the forest fire will go through and kill off almost all the beetles and actually save the forest, as long as it's moving fast and not particularly hot. You know, it just goes through, scars the trees, scorches them, but doesn't burn them down. They regrow. When you're out fishing clear water, and however the water got clear, whether it's just a natural thing for right now or the red tide had something to do with it, because no one really knows. The truth of the matter is, we can guess, everybody else can guess, but the fact is, no one knows. But I do have my ways of, the problem is when you have snook and they can see you, they don't want to bite. Redfish, when they see you, they want to run. So here's your tricky part. You're going up on the flats, you're drifting up to where you want to go, or even idling up with your motor, and all of a sudden you see movement in the water. Now you shut down and you stop and you go, okay, there's fish there, or you're getting up to a place where you're pretty sure there's fish, but the water's really clear. This is a time of year when I used to do charters, I would have two types of rods with me. I would literally have 4.5 to 6 foot ultralight rods, 4 to 10 pound class, little, you know, 1000 series reels on them. We didn't have braid back then. So I'd have 4 to 6 pound test monofilament, very, very light action rods, two piece usually, because they were easier to store. I could put them into things in my center console and fold the two piece end over, you know, with the line rigged in. They were all rigged up, ready to go. So if I got into some small fish, like a school of smaller trout, rat reds, little stuff, I could just pitch shrimp at them or whatever we were doing, and lures, whatever, and catch these fish with them, even schools of smaller snook. But then on the other part, I would have 7.5, 8, 8.5 foot rods on the boat, because if I'm going to try and catch a decent-sized redfish, a decent-sized snook, I got to be way back.
Oh, yeah.
Again, as far as I normally would want to cast.
Well, it takes you way out of your comfort zone because, you know, you need to make those long-distance casts so those fish don't see you, because if you can see them, they see you. So you've got to drift into those areas or trolling motor and make that long cast and hope for the best.
One of the biggest mistakes I made while learning to fish the flats was one day I thought, if I mix a bunch of menhaden oil with some chum and I get on the flats and I put that out, man, I'm going to have every fish in the world coming to me and they won't go around these other boats. I about had people throwing rocks at me. I'm lucky I didn't get shot. I put that mixture in the water and all that menhaden, that fish oil started going across the water. It made it like a mill pond. It was clear surface, just like looking out the windshield of your car. Those redfish looked up, saw all them boats were a half a second before that. It was a light chop on the water, you know, that 2 to 3 inch little chop stuff. And you could kind of see some fish, but not really. And they were all over the place. And that water went clear, and those fish looked up, saw everybody in all the boats, and just poof, they were headed for Texas. They were swimming out of there as fast as they could go. I thought I was going to get killed. I'd start the boat and leave. You know, I said, man, I'm sorry. I thought it would help. And it made the water so clear, the fish saw us, they left. So if you were going to, and tomorrow, RJ, you were going to go out and try to really cast onto those fish, what would be your scenario? How would you rig your rod? I'm going to go let you guys in, then I'm going to figure out what I would do.
Oh, I had to think about that one for a moment. I would probably use an artificial. I wouldn't be tossing a shrimp. And the reason, because I could probably toss an artificial a little more accurately than I can toss a shrimp that's, you know, kind of not balanced on the end of the hook.
Well, what I'm more or less interested in, what would you do to the rod to make it, you know, and if what you're saying is you would use an artificial because it's heavier, you could throw it farther.
Right.
That's what I'm taking out of it anyway. That would be one thing. And that's kind of why you'd be going to the artificial, so you could actually get that distance rather than with a live shrimp?
Yeah.
So RJ's going to go with more weight on the end of the rod.
Okay.
What do you think, Robert? How would you do it?
I mean, number one and foremost, in that clearer water, I'm going to downsize my leader. That's an absolute given for me.
So from what to what?
My comfort factor for generic broad-spectrum flats fishing is 30 pound. So I would actually probably drop down to either 25 or 20 pound. And probably maybe even lengthen it personally just a little bit longer. Instead of using 24 to 30 inches, I'd probably be using like 36 to 40 inches of leader.
So you're going to make your leader a little lighter and a little longer trying to get on those fish.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Me and true Frank style, first thing I'm going to do is get the longest rod I can find. Eight and a half foot, what you can buy readily available without getting stupid in money. And I'm going to downsize my reel at least one size. If I normally have a 4,000 on that rod to balance it out and make it feel good, I'm going to downsize that to a 3, a 25, or even a 2. I'm going to get the smallest reel on there, because the other thing I'm going to do is downsize my line. I'm going to use the smallest line in there, 6-pound braid, 6-pound monofilament, preferably monofilament. So I'm going to need 130 yards, so I'm going to use the smallest reel. I can get 130 yards of 6-pound monofilament on there. I'm going to go monofilament because it's almost invisible in the water. It's clear plastic versus cloth line like braided is. Braided is a form of cloth. It's Kevlar, whatever, fiberglass cloth, whatever. But braided line is some type of actual physical material that you can see, whereas monofilament's clear plastic. So I'm going to use like 6-pound monofilament. I'm going to use a reel that will hold about 130 yards of it, so it's probably going to be pretty small. I'm going to put it on that 8-foot rod, even though it's going to be uncomfortable. It's a little tiny reel, great big rod, and I'm not going to have to lengthen my leader because I went back to monofilament. So I can stay with about a 2.5 foot tied line to line, the monofilament to fluorocarbon leader, but I am going to drop down, like Robert said. I'm going to go down to 20, 25 pound test. I'm going to downsize my hook a little bit. I still need enough hook to get through the tail of a shrimp. If I'm throwing shrimp, I'm hooking them through the tail. If you hook them through the head and you go to cast him, he's going to tumble end over end through the air. That's a lot of wind resistance. It's going to fly literally maybe two-thirds the distance is if I simply take the hook and go from the bottom up right inside of the knuckle on the tail or crossways through the tail right at the very back of the shrimp. All the way it's head first, you can throw it. It's going to fly through the air. So I downsize my reel. Now, that's about line slap on the guides. I want to reduce that friction. I'm not worried about that I have a big reel. I'm worried about I have a big spool. The diameter on a bigger spool on the reel, what it does, the line has to come off in a bigger loop. It's going to rub on the guides more.
A lot more friction.
A lot more friction as the line's going out through. When you hook a fish, if you point your fish at the... When you hook a fish and you point your rod at the fish, let's say you have 2 pounds of drag set on there, which, believe it or not, is probably pretty close, and the fish is pulling line. If you simply lift your rod from, say, you're about 9 o'clock off to the side, and then raise it up to straight up 12 o'clock, you've added 2 to 3 more pounds of drag. That friction on the guides adds 2 to 3 more pounds of pressure to the fish simply by raising your rod tip up. So I know that because I've done the test with the weights, with scales, and I mean, it's scientific. This is not a guess. And it's depending upon how many guides you have, what they're made out of. Reaper uses a super, super hard component that does reduce that friction a lot in the Reaper rod. So that's why it's 2 to 3 pounds, because with a Reaper raising it up, you're probably going to get maybe 2 pounds extra pressure. But you take a manufacturer who has a softer guide component, you can tell they kind of get groove marks in them. That's going to add at least another pound. They're not hard, they're not slick, so the line drags more.
Right.
So by reducing the spool size, not so much the reel size, what I'm really concerned about is how big that spool is, how big the loop of line coming off as you cast and going through the guides. I want to narrow that down, get less friction. So long rod, light line, small reel, and I'm a zinging it way out there. And I can pick up with just the line, say dropping from 20 pound braid down to 6 or 10, I'm going to pick up an extra 10 feet, maybe 15 feet. By reducing the size of the reel, the spool, I'm going to get another 8, maybe 10 feet. You know, by lengthening the rod from, say, a 7 to an 8, I can pick up another 6 feet or so.
And 15 to 20 feet on any given cast is a giant amount of distance to whether those fish are seeing you or not seeing you, being able to fight those fish the whole 9 yards. So every 6 inches of rod, you're adding, what, 5 to 10 feet to a cast?
Yeah, maybe.
And then reducing the line, even that. The only drawback is, what do you do about the accuracy?
I'm good. What do you mean accuracy? Why wouldn't I be accurate?
Well, for me, with a longer rod, I'm less accurate with my
cast.
Because
you can't see it.
Well, that being said, so are,
now, wait a minute,
RJ. A lot of other
people.
We've
got a guy who can't see out there, and he's casting on direction. But when you're closer, you see better. You're going to catch more. You can cast better.
Right, but with a shorter rod, you can skip it a little bit easier and get a little bit more accuracy underneath bushes and around
ducks. All I'm going to do is put my thumb up that rod. I'm doing heavy overhead cast.
I was just going to say that you got to do an overhand cast to get any kind of accuracy with a long cast.
Now, my favorite cast for distance is not accurate. It's kind of like a golf swing. I come way down from the side, and I'm zooming, you know, lifting it up in an arc that way. I can be very accurate on an overhand cast because I got my thumb up the rod. I hold the reel straight away from, you know, my thumbs are on the top. I want the reel pointing, you know, straight up from where my thumb is. So I'm getting a very accurate, I don't want anything angled or beveled. And then I take my arms back and I make sure that thumb points in the direction I want it to go. And I stop on my back cast. Anybody who just whips back and whips forward, it's going to be close, but it's never accurate.
Right, but you also want to load the rod. You want that rod to bend backwards behind you to get that more of that whip effect than when you're throwing the lure.
And the only problem with that is that if that lure's swinging on the way back, if you come straight up over your head and that lure's perfectly in line when you go to whip it forward, it's going to fly that way. But I don't have that kind of luck. When I need to be really accurate, I'm going to bring my rod back, stop, pause, let the lure or the bait stop swinging. So I'm going to get, I don't have that extra whoop to it. So anyway.
And also on a real long distance cast, you know, I haven't done a lot of surf fishing in my life. You want to let release just a tad earlier than what you normally would. Because then you get some height from the toss.
And
if you release once the rod tip is out in front of you, you're actually shooting down towards the surface of the water. So when you're making that long cast, let it go just a little bit sooner than you normally would.
What I try and do is like I'm playing Cowboys and Indians, where you point your finger and go bang, bang.
Yes.
And if I'm doing the bang, bang thing with my finger, and I can have that finger end up at a 45-degree angle going up in the air as I release, that's where I want it to be. But Robert over there, RJ over there, Fish and Frank here, bass fishing, going crazy right now, guys. On the bed or off the bed, Robert, real quick?
Shiners and they're on the bed.
Shiners and they're on the bed. Cool. Any one word, RJ.
Goodbye, RJ. Oh, wait, that was two.
Bye.